Good morning. It's good to see a good number assembled this morning. We appreciate the fact that you're able to be out. Some are not, and we want to continue to remember them in our prayers. It goes without saying, but we're going to say it anyway, that if you have a question about anything that's done or said here, feel free to ask. We encourage your questions. It's our goal to do only what the Bible authorizes, and you can help us to reach that goal. It's been about 11 months, in fact, I looked at my records a day or two ago, since we had a lesson on the subject of racism. That's a hot-button issue today, one that's unpleasant to some, but one that is a subject that some scriptures that deal with related subjects that will help us in this particular time that we live. And so we want to look and begin with our introductory there, and notice that that definition of the word racism means prejudice, discrimination, or antagonism directed toward a person, or against a person, or people on the basis of their membership in a particular racial or ethnic group, typically one that is a minority or marginalized. The belief that different races possess distinct characteristics, abilities, or qualities, especially so as distinguish them as inferior or superior to one another. And then the word discrimination means the unjust or prejudicial treatment of different categories of people or things, especially on the grounds of race, age, or sex. And so there's our definition of racism and also of discrimination. And as we proceed, we want to notice some scriptures in just a moment. But racism is a sin. It's a sin, and the greatest problem faced by all people today is sin. A lot of times we get distracted and focus on something else that's peripheral, but the real problem is sin. And the only real solution is salvation through Jesus Christ, our Lord, and obedience to His gospel. That's what it takes. I don't claim to be an expert on racial problems. I'm not much of an expert on much of anything. Except eating ice cream, I can tell you a few things about that. I had to give a speech on that one time, an impromptu speech, but that's beside the point. But above all, I intend to present truth as revealed in the Scriptures. We'll also be looking and noticing that science agrees with the Bible regarding this subject, and that'll help us. And so it's a subject that relates to our culture today. Are there really different races? Well, to answer that, we must first understand what the Bible, and we're talking about science too, teach about race. The Bible doesn't even use the word race in reference to people, but it does describe all human beings as being of one blood. And in Acts 17, verse 26, the King James, the New King James, the modern English version, all say, "And he made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth, and has determined their pre-appointed times and the boundaries of their dwelling." And this is a similar translation. The New American Standard says, "And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth." The word blood is not in the original text, but the idea is that he made from one. We all came from one, is what the Bible is teaching here. And this emphasizes that we are all related because of that. Now, in the Bible, there's only one race, the human race. The Bible doesn't divide people as society does today, and dividing people as society does today is not all that old. May be surprising to you, but skin color is not the cause of any behavior. It simply doesn't cause any behavior. Wrong behavior happens in spite of skin color, not because of it. And the only biblical references to skin color were not in reference to races as we think of them today. And we'll take a look at those verses so you can see. In the book of Genesis chapter 25, when Esau was born, he was the first one born. The first one came out red. He was like a hairy garment all over, so they called his name Esau. That wasn't a reference to his race. It was just the way he looked when he was born. In the Song of Solomon, the Shulamite says, "I am dark but lovely." Some translations say black. "I am dark but lovely, O daughters of Jerusalem, like the tents of Kedar, like the curtains of Solomon. Do not look upon me because I am dark, because, and here's the reason, the sun has tanned me. My mother's sons were angry with me. They made me the keeper of the vineyards. And then in the fifth chapter, in verse 10 of the Song of Solomon, my beloved is white and ruddy, chief among 10,000. She's just talking about how he looks. She's not talking about races there, because that was unknown at that time. People weren't divided like that. But one's behavior is not caused by the color of his skin, but by his heart. In the Bible, in Matthew chapter 12, I give you an easy way to remember this passage, because it's one we ought to read probably more than we do. And it's like this. Matthew 12, 1, 2, verse 34, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. Matthew 12, 34. Here's what it says. Ye offspring of vipers, how can ye, being evil, speak good things? For out of the abundance of the heart the mouth speaketh. The good man out of his good treasure bringeth forth good things, and the evil man out of his evil treasure bringeth forth evil things. And so there's a passage that we all need to be aware of in the Bible. And Jesus wasn't a revolutionary in the sense of riling people to and forcing people to overthrow the government by force. He wasn't trying to do that. Instead, he sought to change people's hearts, because that's where the problem is. You might force people to behave a certain way, but until you reach their hearts, that's not the ultimate goal. We need to reach their hearts. And if we're just trying to talk about skin color and making that the issue, Jesus tried to reach people from the inside out. That's how he revolutionized people, not through force and marches and demonstrations, all that. And by teaching such things as the golden rule, we call it that because it is golden, whatsoever ye would that men do to you, do ye likewise to them. In Luke 6 and verse 31, Matthew 7, 12, Matthew's account of it. Also, we have some teaching about rendering good for evil in the book of Romans in chapter 12. And let's notice verses 17 and 20 and 21. Verse 17, render to no man evil for evil. Take thought for things honorable in the sight of all men. Verse 20, but if thine enemy hunger, feed him. If he thirst, give him to drink. For in so doing thou shalt reap coals of fire upon his head. Be not overcome of evil, but overcome evil with good. And then there's Matthew 5 and verse 44 that teaches us to love our enemies and to do good to them. That's the kind of teaching that will destroy racism. That's the kind of teaching that kind of destroyed slavery. And in the Old Testament, slavery served as a means of loaning money to others who indentured themselves for a certain period of time until they worked off the debt. And it began to be abused when people started trading human life as a commodity for sale. That's when that began to change. You know, Job recognized that all were equal before God and that they ought to be treated as image bearers of the Creator. And we might notice that in the book of Job in chapter 31. He said, if I have despised the cause of my male or female servant when they complained against me, what then shall I do when God rises up? When he punishes, how shall I answer him? Did not he who made me in the womb make them? Did not the same one fashion us in the womb? That's Job talking about the servant, his servant at that time. And so the teaching of Christ and the apostles resulted in changed hearts, which produced changed behavior. And that's what we're really after. And through that end brought social change. That's how the Lord brought social change, was by teaching and reaching people's hearts. I thought it was interesting in reading about this that John Newton, who wrote the hymn Amazing Grace, was eventually he became an abolitionist after he embraced the scriptures, and certainly forced enslavement is condemned. It goes against the condemnation of men stealers. In 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 10, these are condemned for the sexually immoral, homosexual, slave traders. The American Standard says men stealers. The English Standard says enslavers. The NIV says kidnappers and liars and perjurers and whatever else is contrary to sound teaching. Brother Herschel Patton, in his commentary on 1 Timothy, says Andropodistes refers to a slave dealer, a kidnapper, a man-stealer, as well as to all who exploit persons for their own selfish purposes. And I believe that describes it pretty well. In the 1800 years before Charles Darwin, Most people, when talking about race, might be referring to such things as the English race or the Irish race. However, this all changed in 1859 with the writing of Darwin's book, published his book on the origin of the species. And there's a subtitle of that book that most people don't realize, but here's the subtitle, and people don't want to talk about it today. It says, On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection or the Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. Notice that favored races that he mentions there. And so as we think about that, his title of his book, Darwinian Evolution was and still is inherently a racist philosophy. Christians have often been influenced by it. He teaches that different groups of races of people evolved at different times and rates, so that some groups are more like the ape-like ancestors and others are not. And leading the evolutionist Stephen Jay Gould, who claimed, and he's a household word among evolutionists, he's passed away now, biological arguments for racism may have been common before 1859, but they increased by orders of magnitude following the acceptance of evolutionary theory. And so what I'm saying is this, that the word race can be tied to evolution. It took on a different twist of meaning at that time. Before, race didn't refer to people's skin colors, and we've already pointed that out. We've seen words change. We recognize how words change in meaning. We've seen the word weed. Most of us, 50 years ago, wouldn't have thought the word weed was going to refer to marijuana, but it does. We wouldn't have thought that the word gay was going to refer to homosexuality, but it does today. And the same thing's kind of happened with the word race. It kind of took a different meaning with the coming of evolution and the teaching of Charles Darwin. The Australasian Aborigines were considered the missing links between the ape-like ancestors and the rest of mankind, and that's from The Missing Links, Early Dawn of History, published in New York. And we could give several quotations here. I'm not going to take the time to do all that, of several racist statements made by evolutionists. But as a result of Darwinian evolution, many people started thinking in terms of the different people groups around the world representing different races. And so the term race began to apply to skin color and perhaps facial shapes, the eyes and the mouth and all that. And Christians have been affected by that philosophy. And so this has resulted in many people today consciously or unconsciously having ingrained prejudices against certain groups of people. However, all human beings in the world today are classified biologically as Homo sapiens sapiens. That's how they're classified. Scientists today admit that biologically there really is only one race of humans. I think that's interesting, because that coincides with what the Bible teaches. There's only one race of humans. For instance, a scientist at the Advancement of Science Convention in Atlanta, and I think I've got that on here, said race is only a social construct derived mainly from perceptions conditioned by events of recorded history, and it has no basic biological reality. Curiously enough, the idea comes very close to being of American manufacture. I thought that was an interesting statement there by R.L. Holtz. And reporting on research conducted on the concept of race, ABC News stated, more and more scientists find that the difference that sets us apart are cultural, not racial. Some even say that the word race should be abandoned because it's meaningless. It went on to say that we accept the idea of race because it's a convenient way of putting people into broad categories, frequently to suppress them. The most hideous example was provided by Hitler's Germany, and racial prejudice remains common throughout the world. That was ABC News back in 1998. And also an article in the Journal of Counseling and Development said, more recently, those working on mapping the human genome announced that they had put together a draft of the entire sequence of the human genome, and the researchers had unanimously declared there is only one race, the human race. And that's do the races differ? Not really, DNA shows, from the New York Times. So there are several quotes there that coincide with what we just pointed out from the Bible. The Bible doesn't recognize different races. There is one human race. All of us are from one blood, from one man. And the Bible teaches that. We just saw the scriptures on that. And so thinking about that, and then in August the 22nd, year 2000, New York Times, it says, scientists have long suspected that the racial categories recognized by society are not reflected in the genetic level. But the more closely that researchers examine the human genome, the complement of genetic materials encased in the heart of almost every cell of the body, most of them are convinced that the standard labels used to distinguish people by race have little or no biological meaning. You know, we sing a song in Vacation Bible School and in the children's classes, Jesus loves the little children, red, yellow, black, and white. They are precious in His sight. We are not literally those colors. We're not really red or yellow or black or white. When Jesus said, suffer the little children and forbid them not to come unto me, and for such is the kingdom of heaven, there in Matthew 19, verse 14, He didn't distinguish between skin colors. Scientists have discovered that there's one major pigment called melanin that all humans have that produces skin color. And there are two main forms of that. There's eumelanin and pheomelanin. They refer that give what we consider different colors, different shades. And these combine, he points out, to give us the particular shade of skin that we had. So we're really all the same color. We're just different shades of the same color. It's more like a paint sample. You can go to the paint store and see if I can find that picture. I think I've got let me get to it. Here it comes. A paint sample. You may get something like that. Those are not seven different colors. Those are seven shades of the same color. And that's kind of more accurately describes what human beings are. And let me go back to the quote I was working on and see if I can get there. Yeah. If one were to take any two people anywhere in the world, scientists have found the basic genetic differences between these two people would typically be about 0.2, not 0.2, not 2%, but 0.2%, even if they came from the same people group. That's in Discover Magazine, which is a published scientific publication. Also, I think we gave this, the so-called racial characteristics, skin color, eye shape, account for only 0.012% of human biological variation. So it's interesting, some of these things that the geneticists have said that really coincide with what we find in the Bible. We might notice also, and I think we already gave that quote, we already went that one, so we won't quote it again. And so we're back to where we were. So the geneticists are saying that racial characteristics are only minor variations. They're minor variations in people groups. And so thinking about that, essentially, there's essentially no genetic difference in people of different skin color, and that's why people of different races can exchange blood and organs, organ transplants. One article I read did point out that sickle cell anemia is largely present among the races from Africa and is thought to be an adaptive response to malaria. But on the other hand, cystic fibrosis affects mostly Caucasians. So that's not a major difference. As far as people are concerned, we just have certain weaknesses toward certain diseases. But on January the 2nd, 1968, the third heart transplant took place in the world. Dr. Philip Blyberg, a dentist in South Africa, Cape Town, South Africa, was able to successfully undergo a heart transplant. Blyberg received his heart from a 24-year-old Clive Haught, a black man who had collapsed on a Cape Town beach the day before. And this supports the biblical teaching that God has made of one every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth, that we could take the heart from a black man's body and it works in a white man's body. In fact, some articles I've read point out that if you take a person of another race who has your same blood type, you may have more genetically in common with them than you do somebody of your race that doesn't have the same blood type you do, because you can't receive a transplant from that person who may not match up genetically with your blood type, but you can from that person of another race. So those are some interesting things we want to point out. Of course, racism has been a problem in our country. We don't like to be reminded of it. Many of us would rather hide than talk about it. But many of us can remember the civil rights movement in our country back in the 1950s. And about 1954, that happened. Here we have the U.S. Marshals escort six-year-old Ruby Bridges from William France Elementary School in New Orleans, first grader. She had to be escorted, and you can imagine what she was feeling that day. We all remember Little Rock, the Little Rock Nine, and how they made fun of this girl as she was going into school, especially this woman back here has a scowl on her face. And I read that this woman later apologized to this girl for the things she said on that particular day. Here, mothers escorting their children to school. Here's one little black boy. That's a school. You can't read that. I think it's in Oklahoma. They had a bomb scare, and the school had to be turned out because of that one little boy that was attending school there. And those pictures could be multiplied many times over. These could, too. Here are some school students are being sprayed with fire hoses. You may not realize how much pressure a fire hose has, but it can break ribs. It's that powerful. And here are some where dogs were turned loose on them. Again, these could be multiplied many times over. It's not our purpose to do that, but simply to point out what was happening in our country. And then there was this, the water fountains. And this is on display in the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute. Two water fountains stood side by side, one a modern machine capable of delivering cool water, the other a sink with a water fountain attached to delivery tap water. And they stand as symbols. And some of the ones that I remember, I'm telling you how old I am, I can remember the water for the other people was around back. They didn't even get close to the same water cooler. They had to go around back to drink water or to go to a restroom or anything like that. And those things really happened in our society. We don't like to come to terms with that. From 1877 to 1950, 3,959 black men, women, and children were lynched in the 12 southern states, many without a trial. No trial. They were just taken out by groups that were active at that time. Georgia tops the list with 586 lynchings. You can try to imagine somebody saying, "I will accept your heart transplant and blood transfusion from your body, but I can't drink at the same water fountain with you." Imagine that. Well, that's absurd. Yes, we can agree that with that. But real science in the present fits with the biblical view that all people are rather closely related and that there is one race biologically and biblically. And so with that in mind, we want to point out that Satan and the media as his tool wants us to blame each other for problems that exist in society. And each side can point to the other side and see bad things. That's a useless argument. Somebody's always going to be able to top you with something worse. I know I've heard people talk about the South Side of Chicago and all the black-on-black crime that's going on there, and that's terrible. It really is. But have you ever talked about the fact that the serial killers have nearly all been white and their victims were white? We don't want to talk about that. Or the school shootings, nearly every one of them have been white and their victims have mostly been white. Even mass shootings at churches where mass shooters have gone into churches, most of the victims have been white. And so as you think about that, or most of the perpetrators rather have been white, and Satan wants us to blame it on race. He wants us to think about race. That's not where the problem is. The problem is sin. That's where the problem is. We need a Savior to save us from our sins. And we're never going to get to the end of the argument as long as we keep arguing this race against that race. That's where the devil wants it to be focused. It needs to be focused on the subject of sin because racism is a sin. And so the Bible says all have sinned. That's everybody. All have sinned and come short of the glory of God. And to argue about race misses the point. Sin is the point. And the devil would like us to get off of that and talk about race. You know, it's interesting. I think we've got, Galatians chapter 2, that when Jewish brethren came and Paul confronted Cephas at Antioch, when Jewish brethren came in, he had been eating with the Gentiles. Let's just read it. But when Cephas came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he was clearly wrong. Until some men arrived from James, he was in the habit of eating with the Gentiles. But after those men came, he withdrew from the Gentiles and would not associate with them any longer because he was afraid of the circumcision party. The other Jews also joined him in this hypocritical behavior, to the extent that even Barnabas was caught up in their hypocrisy. Keep in mind, Paul's writing this, he was a Jew of Jews. He was a Hebrew of Hebrews. But he learned the truth. But when I saw that they were not acting consistently with the truth of the gospel, King James says, not walking upright according to the truth of the gospel, I told Cephas in front of everyone, though you are a Jew, you've been living like a Gentile, not like a Jew. So how can you insist that the Gentiles must live like Jews? And so he was confronted on that occasion by the Apostle Paul. Peter wanted to roll back the clock when those Jewish brethren came in. He wanted segregation again. That's what he wanted. He didn't want to be mixing with people of another group. And sometimes people express those ideas even today, of wanting to roll back the clock, maybe close to 70 years back in this country. They want to roll it back to where things were said to be separate but equal. They never were equal. I can remember in the hometown I grew up in, I remember the state-of-the-art schools that we attended. I remember the one in the community of a minority race there, how dilapidated it was and how old it was, that those things were there. And so a lot of people want to roll it back. They still want separate water fountains and restrooms and the back of the bus and having to give up your seat on the bus and separate schools and churches. It never was separate but equal. It wasn't equal. And we need to be honest about that. And I want to read an article to you, and we'll be kind of bringing this to a close. The article a little bit long. This happened in our country. Bushmen share a cage with the Bronx Park apes. Some laugh over his antics, but many are not pleased. And the keeper frees him at times. And this man's name is Odabinga. This is him, second from left. Several tribesmen were captured in Africa and brought over here for the World's Fair in 1904 in St. Louis. You've heard that song, Meet Me in St. Louis, Louis, Meet Me at the Fair. That's the fair that was talking about, 1904. And he was put in a cage with animals and kept there. During the 1904 World's Fair in St. Louis, Samuel Phillips Verner was commissioned by the World's Fair organizers to import pygmies from Africa for display, Coker said. That is how Odabinga arrived in St. Louis. At the end of the World's Fair, he was traded to the Bronx Zoo, where he was caged with primates as living proof of human evolution from apes. He was touted as proof of the missing link. And in regard to that, I have an article. It's a little bit long, but bear with me as we read it. A teenage boy brought from his homeland in Central Africa and displayed at the Bronx Zoo in New York, New York. In 1885, King Leopold was allowed to take possession of the Congo Free State. To make his possession profitable, Leopold began to exploit the region's resources and imposed forced labor on inhabitants. The Mbuti pygmies, which often were reinforced by beatings, amputations, and murder. When Binga returned from an elephant hunt, he found his entire family and village had been slaughtered. Now alone and defenseless, he was kidnapped by slave traders and put to work as a laborer in an agricultural village. In 1904, Binga was freed, with quotation, I put quotation marks around the word freed, by an American missionary, an amateur anthropologist, he was, Samuel Phillips Verner, who was under contract from the Louisiana Purchase Exposition to bring back pygmies to be part of a human exhibition at the World's Fair in St. Louis. This turned out to be real freedom, not to be real freedom after all. The Africans were displayed, and Odabinga became a particular popular performer who attracted huge crowds. On exhibit at the same time was with the Apache chief Geronimo. The two became friends. For his efforts, Verner was awarded a gold medal in anthropology. Verner took Binga to the Bronx Zoo, where he was initially hired to help with the animals. Zoo officials began to exhibit him in the monkey house, where he again attracted large crowds. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch mocked the exhibit with one offensive headline after another. Pygmies demand monkey diet. Pygmies scorn cash. Demand watermelons. In one article, it was claimed that Binga was the only genuine cannibal in America today. On the fairgrounds where several of these captured boys were displayed, they were pinched, prodded, and poked while their pet parrots and monkeys were taunted and burned with cigars. As temperatures dropped, they were subjected to the frigid backgrounds without adequate clothing or shelter. Behind the scenes, they were measured, photographed, and plaster casts were taken for busts. By Sunday, September the 16th, Bingo was no longer in the cage, but roamed the park under the watchful eye of park rangers. That day, a record 40,000 people visited the zoo. Wherever Bingo went, hordes followed in hot pursuit. The rowdy crowd chased Bingo, and when he was cornered, some people poked him in the ribs or tripped him, while others merely laughed at the sight of a frightened pygmy. Bingo struck several visitors and took three men to get him back to the monkey house. Hornaday complained that it is utterly impossible to control him, and that Bingo threatened to bite the keepers whenever they tried to bring him back to the monkey house. What would you have done? When Bingo proved to be a popular attraction, a group of black New York clergymen led by a man named Reverend James Gordon demanded that he be freed. The clergyman had no success, but vowed to take up the next day with the city's mayor. Their complaint did catch the attention of New York Times, whose editor was dismayed that anyone might protest against the display. He said, "We do not understand all the emotion which others are expressing," the paper said. "Otabenga is a normal specimen of his race or tribe, with a brain as much developed as are those of his other members. Whether they're really closer to the anthropoid apes than the other African savages, or whether they're viewed as the degenerate descendants of ordinary Negroes, they're of equal interest to the student of ethnology and can be studied with profit." You see how this is playing into evolution and how, under the name of education, almost anything can go. The editorial said it was absurd to imagine Bingo suffering or humiliation. "Pygmies are very low on the human scale, and the suggestion that Bingo should be in a school instead of a cage ignores the high probability that school would be a place of torture to him. The idea that men are much alike, except as they have had or lacked opportunities for getting an education of books, is now far out of date." That's what they said back then. Well, we've got men today performing surgery, it's still in the womb, on conjoined twins, men from that race. Bingo's exhibition on the hallowed grounds of the New York Zoological Gardens was not mere entertainment, it was educational. They believe Bingo belonged to an inferior species. Putting him on display in the zoo promoted the higher ideas of modern civilization. Those ideas embedded in science, history, government policies, and popular culture would render Bingo's discomfort and humiliation in a monkey house cage incomprehensible to the vast majority of those who witnessed it. That could have occurred in America's most cosmopolitan city in the 20th century would seem enough cause for astonishment. But what appears on the surface to be a saga of one man's degradation, a shameful spectacle, is on close inspection the story of an era of science, of elite men and institutions, of racial ideologies that still endure today. But it is possible to return to the archives and reconstruct the real circumstances by which Otabenga, before the age of adulthood, was stolen from his home in Central Africa and brought to New York City for the amusement and education of its residents. Samuel Werner, the self-styled explorer who took Benga from the Congo, keep in mind he was a missionary, not good for them, and collaborated with the Smithsonian Institute and National Geographic Society, and even the U.S. Secretary of State, gave his only concession to a reporter in an apparent nod to Christian sensitivities that care would be taken not to exhibit Bingo on Sundays. William Hornaday, the zoologist and founding director of Bronx Zoo, was so pleased by the attendance figures at the zoo that he quietly began making plans to keep Bingo on display through the autumn and possibly until the following spring. He told reporters that Bingo had been put in the primate house because that's the most comfortable place we could find for him. When the black ministers went to City Hall to meet the mayor of New York, George McClellan, who happened to serve as an ex officio member of the Zoological Society, they planned to appeal for Bingo's immediate release, but they didn't get past the reception area. Given the runaround, the mayor's secretary said he was too busy to meet with them. They were told to go see Madison Grant, secretary of the Zoological Society, but he was unhelpful, telling them he would only be on display a little while longer. When Gordon, the black minister, returned to the zoo that afternoon, he found Bingo with a guinea pig in a cage surrounded by several hundred spectators. The crowd seemed to annoy the dwarf, the New York Times reported. Gordon was finally able to hire a lawyer, and under threat of a lawsuit, Bingo was quietly released, By the end of 1906, 23-year-old Bingham, now at this time, was released to Gordon, who placed him in the New York City's Howard Colored Orphan Asylum. In 1910, Gordon arranged for Bingham to relocate to Lynchburg, Virginia, where he received formal schooling and religious training for the first time. Bingham began working at a tobacco factory to pay for his journey back to Central Africa. By 1914, World War I began and severely limited passenger ship travel. He wasn't able to go back. As he and the boys of the orphanage grew older, something changed. By 1916, Bingham had lost interest in their excursions to hunt and fish and no longer seemed so eager a friend to the neighborhood children. Many had noticed his darkening disposition, his all-consuming longing to go home. For hours, he would sit alone in silence under a tree. Some of his young companions would recall decades later a song he used to sing, which he had learned at the theological seminary, "I Believe I'll Go Home. Lordy, won't you help me?" In the late afternoon of March the 19th, 1916, the boys watched as Bingham gathered wood to build a fire in the field. As the fire rose to a brilliant flame, Bingham danced around it while chanting and moaning. The boys had seen this ritual before, but this time they detected a profound sorrow. He seemed eerily distant, as vacant as a ghost. That night as they slept, Oda Bingham stole into a battered gray shed across the road from his home. Before daybreak, he picked up a gun that he had hidden there and fired a single bullet through his own heart. In the harrowing stillness, he was freed. End of the article. Less than 1 year ago, July the 31st, 2020, the present Bronx Zoo operator apologized for the racist display of an African man in 1906. Oda Bingham, a Central African man, was put on display in the Monkey House in 1906 before black ministers brought the disgraceful incident to an end, the zoo operator said. Harvey Bloom, who co-authored the 1992 book, Oda Bingham, The Pygmy at the Zoo, said the zoo's apology is too little and too late. And to whom was this apology? It's a little too late for Oda, Bloom told NBC News. On September the 12th, 2017, a historical marker was placed in Lynchburg, Virginia, in memory of Oda Bingham. The organization, founded in 1895 as the New York Zoological Society, also denounced the eugenics-based pseudoscientific racism, writings, and philosophies. And it set the stage, said, for Hitler's belief in a superior race. And so, if the Christian's reaction to this is not one of horror and disgrace, then something is wrong. You have to wonder about things like that and people's thinking and what was going on at that time, even today in some of the things. We need to understand that the repudiation of racism is not a side point of the Christianity. It's not a side point of the gospel. It is the point. Christ died reconciling all men in one body, men of all tribes and tongues. And the gospel is for all nations. It never was intended that God have a special nation as an end in itself. That special nation was because of a promise God made to Abraham. And that nation often disobeyed and they were punished. But it was to bless all nations by bringing Christ into the world. And he's the one that reconciled all men into one body. One body. That's the church. And can you imagine a member of your physical body, your hand, saying, "I don't have one having to do with that left arm of mine." We're in the same body as Christians. We need to recognize that. So, repudiating racism and the death of Christ reconciled all men together. We've got to learn that. And it's not a side issue of the gospel. It is the heart of the gospel, of bringing all men together. And we need to recognize that. What Paul said to Peter there in that passage we had up there a moment ago, he was talking about Peter's attitude of wanting to segregate. It was a racist attitude, and he said he walked not uprightly according to the gospel. That's a lesson we have to learn. There are a lot of things that have been swept under the rug. We don't like to talk about them, but we need to face the facts. And so the repudiation of racism is not a side point. We've already covered most of those points there. Partiality. What scriptures show racism is a sin? James chapter 2, verses 1 through 10. Won't take the time to read it. Galatians 2, we've already read in verses 11 and 12. And in Acts chapter 10, when Peter went to the house of Cornelius, Acts verse 38, and he said unto them, "You yourselves know how it is unlawful thing for a man that is a Jew to join himself or to come unto one of another nation, and yet unto me has God showed that I should not call any man common or unclean." Notice the issue there was not race, it was another nation. The nations were separated because of their idolatry. Israel wasn't to mix with those nations, not for racial reasons, but for religious reasons, because of the idolatry, and because it would stood the chance of corrupting the seed through which Christ was to come. And so we need to realize that our standing before God may rest on things like this. God may ask us to account for some things that we may have done or said in the past. And so we need to realize that Christ is ready and willing to forgive anybody of anything that they've ever done, but it takes an acknowledgement of that and repentance from our hearts. And that will bring us into fellowship with God once again. This morning, if you're subject to the Lord's invitation in any way, you need to realize that the gospel is for all. It's for you. And the Lord intended it for you. And you and you and you. Everybody. Regardless of the color of their skin. If you haven't obeyed the gospel, you need to repent and be baptized into Christ this very day. We hope you will as we stand and sing the hymn that's been selected.